all of us know that of the eight limbs or branches of yoga, the first one is something called yama, which consists of five negative statements, five prohibitions, and of those, the very first prohibition is ahimsa, nonviolence, harmlessness. And as we all know, theosophy is the yoga of the West. So the very first step of yoga is nonviolence. And that would seem to take care of that, which means I have nothing more to say. But then I wouldn't be saying yes, ma'am, to Dora, so I have to say something on the subject. In any case, it's been my experience that when two theosophists get together, there are likely to be three opinions among them. A fact well illustrated yesterday afternoon in our session on the Socratic method. So what exactly is a non-violent response to violence? What is a harmless response to harm? Is it doing nothing? If not, what do we do? How does non-violence apply in specific cases? Well, this morning I'm going to give you an opportunity to help me learn the answers to those questions. We're going to conduct a kind of theosophical Gallup poll. And if the pollsters would please now pass out the polls. We have here some very simple printed poll sheets. If each of you would take one. And immediately after the pollsters, if you have something to write with, you're going to need to write now. That's splendid. If you don't, why, two other pollsters will pass along with pencils. So if you need a pencil, raise a hand. These are the smallest pencils in the world. They are the stubs left from my editorial work with the magazine American Speech. I saved them for 10 years knowing they would come in handy sometime. This poll, I might add, I won't vouch for the scientificness of it, but it is a completely anonymous poll. You are not asked to sign the sheet. I'm going to collect them as soon as you finish, and we'll tabulate them, but I'm not asking you to sign it or to identify yourself in any way. What I do ask is that you answer the questions I'm going to put to you as honestly as you possibly can. Did everybody get a printed poll sheet? What I'm going to do is to present you with a number of hypothetical situations. Hypothetical, but by no means impossible situations. And I'm going to ask you what you think you would do, how you think you would respond to these situations, given a very limited range of possible responses. I'll tell you, each situation will have only two possible responses, and I'll ask you to choose one of the two. Everybody have a sheet now? Okay, and you respond simply by circling either the letter A or the letter B. I'll tell you the situation, I'll give you the two possible responses, and then ask you to circle A or B. First, let's suppose that you are walking down a city street late at night. You are alone. Suddenly, out of the shadows steps a very large man who pushes you against the wall of the building and says with a threatening voice, "Give me your money, all of it." You instinctively take a few steps to the right to get away, but he follows you, pulling a knife, saying, "Now." As you fumble for your wallet, suddenly you realize that directly behind the man is an uncovered manhole. If you quickly give him a push, he'll fall into it, quite possibly breaking a leg. What do you do? Do you give the mugger your money, or do you push him? If you give the mugger your money, circle A. If you push him into the manhole, circle B. Those are the alternatives. Second, suppose you are a policeman walking down that same street at midday. You see a chimpanzee that has escaped from a local pet shop. The street is full of pedestrians, and the chimpanzee, which is obviously in a state of great agitation, is attacking some of the people. It's already bitten several of them. What do you do? Do you go to a telephone and call the animal detail to come with tranquilizer darts while the monkey continues rampaging? Or do you pull out your gun and shoot the chimpanzee? It's a fully grown adult male chimpanzee. If you go to the telephone and call the animal detail to come and assist you, circle A. If you shoot the chimpanzee, circle B. I might add that although some of these situations have been made up, some of them, such as the one I have just reported, is an actual situation which happened in Atlanta within the last month. I won't tell you now. I'll tell you later. All right, ready for the third? Three, suppose that you are a physician. One of your patients is a young woman who is pregnant in her fifth month. Earlier in her pregnancy, you prescribed a drug, a new drug, which she took for some time. Now you have discovered that the drug has side effects, hitherto unknown, that can damage a fetus. Tests reveal that the fetus is indeed malformed. The woman requests an abortion. What do you do? Do you refuse to perform the abortion, or do you perform the abortion? If you refuse to perform the abortion, circle A. If you perform the abortion, circle B. Fourth, you are still a physician. A woman in her mid-20s and in excellent health comes to you. She is in her fifth month of pregnancy, but unmarried. She says she is unwilling to have a child and requests you to abort the pregnancy. She is sexually active, uses birth control only sporadically, and has had abortions before. What do you do? Do you refuse to perform the abortion, or do you perform the abortion? If you refuse, circle A. If you perform the abortion, circle B. Fifth, you are driving your automobile in very heavy traffic. You were stopped at an intersection by a red light. There's a long line of cars behind you. From the rear of the line, one car drives forward on the shoulder of the road on your right and pulls up next to you. The driver clearly intends to cut in ahead of you once the light turns green. What do you do? Do you let the other driver cut in ahead of you when the light turns green, or do you gun your engine and go forward to prevent him from cutting in? If you let the other driver cut in ahead of you, circle A. If you gun your engine to move ahead, circle B. This is another one of the real ones. This happened to us, happened to me, on our way here. This is an anonymous poll. I won't tell you what I did. Sixth, ready for the sixth problem? You are the President of the United States. The island of Guam has been attacked and captured by Indonesia, which claims it has rightful ownership, rightful title to that island on historical grounds. The present inhabitants of the island overwhelmingly want to remain as an American protectorate. But Indonesia is on the island and in military command of it. They have also rejected any discussion of the sovereignty of the island and have declared that the only issue they will discuss is how to evacuate those islanders who want to leave. What do you do? Do you prepare to evacuate the inhabitants of Guam, or do you alert the Navy for an invasion of the island? If you prepare to evacuate the inhabitants, circle A. If you alert the Navy for an invasion of Guam, circle B. Some of these, you see, are purely mythical. Okay, seventh. I might add that the next two, the seventh and the eighth, I have borrowed from a recent, from an article in a recent issue of Newsweek magazine. So they aren't mine. Seventh, you are director of the FBI. A terrorist has hidden an atomic bomb on the island of Manhattan. It is set to detonate within a few days, unless he is paid several million dollars, some friends of his who are in prison for acts of terrorism are released, and they are all furnished with safe passage to Libya. The FBI has the terrorist in custody, but have no leads on the location of the bomb. One of your subordinates suggests that the only way to find the location of the bomb is to subject the terrorist to physical torture. What do you do? Do you wait, hoping the terrorist will have a change of heart? Or do you tell the subordinate to try torture? If you wait, hoping the terrorist will have a change of heart or other information will come to light, circle A. If you tell your subordinate to try torture, circle B. No third choice. Eighth, you are the mother of a newborn child. Your child has been kidnapped by a terrorist group and is being held hostage for the release of political prisoners, other terrorists in jail. The leader of the terrorist group has been caught but refuses to reveal the whereabouts of the baby. The FBI tells you that they have no clues but are considering the use of pressure, that is, physical torture, to discover where the kidnappers have the baby, your baby. What do you do? Do you ask them not to use physical violence on the kidnapper? Or do you tell them you hope they'll do whatever is necessary? If you tell them you hope they will not use physical violence on the terrorists, circle A. If you tell them you hope they will do whatever is necessary, circle B. See, I told you we were going to have a morning of violence. Ninth, you are a member of a branch of the society, a local branch, Lodge Study Center, to which a new person has applied for membership. This person is a member of the Ku Klux Klan and of a political party organized along Nazi lines and affiliated with the Klan. He says he intends to continue his membership in the Klan and in the neo-Nazi party, but that also he is in sympathy with the three objects of the society. And he sees no conflict between these memberships. You are asked to vote on his admission. What do you do? Do you vote to admit him, or do you vote to deny him admission? If you vote to admit him, circle A. If you vote to deny him admission, circle B. Tenth and last, you are a member of a jury that must sentence a convicted murderer. This is his fifth conviction for murder. Twice he killed during the course of armed robberies. Once he was a hired killer. Once he killed a fellow inmate in prison. This time he murdered a kidnap victim. Your choice is to vote for life imprisonment with automatic review for parole in 10 years or for the death penalty. What do you do? Do you vote for life imprisonment with possibility of parole? If so, circle A. Or do you vote for the death penalty? If so, circle B. And now if the pollsters would please pass among you and gather up, if you just pass your papers over to one side. Matthew, are you around? And the other pollsters will gather up the pencils so that I can use them for another 10 years. There are too many questions on this poll for us to get the results to you immediately, but we might be able to get the results back this morning for one question. Is there one question that you would particularly like to know how the group responded to? Well, we'll get the results out eventually for all of them, but I thought that this morning there's a possibility we'd get them out for at least one right now. The one on Manhattan and the atomic bomb. Anybody else? Is that all right with everybody? The one on Guam. How many would prefer to have Manhattan and the atomic bomb? How many would prefer to have Guam? It's about evenly divided. We'll let the pollster decide. Okay. Guam is number 6 and Manhattan is number 7. But we will get the results published to all of them so you can find out what your fellows thought about these. Now, these problems obviously vary very greatly in seriousness and in their possible consequences. But none of them, I think, is necessarily a clear-cut moral issue. I think all of them are fuzzy. Some are concocted, some more than others, as I mentioned to you. And the possible responses in each case were limited to two, and that's unrealistic for most situations. However, I suspect that we have not all agreed on which of those two responses we would prefer for any given problem. These problems, like most of those we face in everyday life, are not clear-cut choices between right and wrong, between good and bad, but rather choices between two or more options, none of which is clearly satisfactory. If life is a banquet, too often we find that the menu consists entirely of dishes, all of which give us indigestion. There's a cartoon in my hometown newspaper called Kudzu. Do any of you know this? Have any of you seen this cartoon, Kudzu? Oh, some of you have, so it's been around. Okay. It's about a teenage boy in a small southern town who's trying to find his way about in a confused and frustrating world. His chief advisor is a preacher of uncertain denomination who aspires to be a spiritual counselor to the rich and powerful, only who hasn't made it. One day, young Kudzu, as the boy is called, complains, "Life is hard, preacher." And the preacher responds in his best pulpit voice, "Kudzu, son, life is a test and you gotta be prepared." "Oh," answers Kudzu, "I'm prepared for the test, preacher, But I prepared for true-false, and it's turning out to be multiple choice. Well, that's exactly our problem. We would prefer that our tests be true-false, because that's an easy kind of test to take. As Plato said, although we didn't all agree with him yesterday afternoon, those who know the right will choose the right. So true-false tests are the easiest ones to pass. But the tests in our life are generally multiple-choice ones, and the directions read, as they always do for multiple-choice tests, choose the best response. Only none of the responses seem wholly adequate to the question. Well, how does theosophy help in such dilemmas? How does it help us with problems of war and violence and to make decisions about how we respond to those problems? In HPB's Key to Theosophy, the inquirer asks, have you any ethical system that you carry out in the society? And the theosophist answers, the ethics are there, ready and clear enough for whoever would follow them. They are the essence and cream of the world's ethics, gathered from the teachings of the great reformers. Therefore, you will find represented therein Confucius and Zoroaster, Lao Tzu and the Bhagavad Gita, the precepts of Gautama Buddha and Jesus of Nazareth, of Hillel and his school, as of Pythagoras, Socrates, Plato, and their schools. End of quote. The ethics of all of those reformers and schools might be summed up simply in the Golden Rule. In whatever words it is expressed, it's the basis for ethical action, and hence also of our response to violence. Deal with others as you would have them deal with you. The rule, of course, is sometimes phrased in the negative. Don't do to others what you wouldn't want them to do to you, and then it's known as the silver rule, and people have argued about which of those two forms is the better. There is also, I might add, another form known as the brass rule, which is do unto others before they do to you. The golden rule, however, as it is usually expressed, is in an exoteric form. The esoteric form of that rule might go something like this. There are no others. So whatever you seem to do to another, you actually do to yourself. That esoteric form of the rule follows from the third fundamental proposition of the secret doctrine, the fundamental identity of all souls with the universal oversoul. If you and I are indeed one, identical with each other through our identity with the ultimate ground of all being, then how could I ever want to harm or do violence to myself? All beings desire their own well-being. I must therefore wish for you what I would wish for myself, since we are one. The golden rule can also be summarized in the single word, ahimsa. In dealing with our fellow beings who are ourselves under another guise, we must be harmless, nonviolent. That is, deal with them as we would have them deal with us, or as we would deal with ourselves. But does nonviolence always mean doing nothing? Just passively observing what others do? Well, not necessarily, I think. There are times when ahimsa must be very active. Indeed, there are times when it is required to do what might look like violence and harmfulness. Think for a moment about children. Being kind to a child is not necessarily permitting it to do whatever it likes, whenever it likes. A child who has no restrictions, no rules, no penalties for infringements is not a happy child. Anyone who's raised children will know that that's the case. In fact, it will be an emotionally disturbed, ill-behaved, thoroughly unhappy brat. Children want and need to know the limits of acceptable behavior. And they will test those limits to discover them, to find out what they really are as opposed to what they are said to be. Children are very smart. They know the difference between what is said and what is. The parent who punishes a child that has violated the limits of acceptable behavior is not engaged in an act of violence, but on the contrary is practicing the golden rule, and thus ahimsa at a higher level. In The Key to Theosophy, HPB, when discussing self-sacrifice as the highest standard of behavior, added this. We theosophists say, however, that self-sacrifice has to be performed with discrimination. And such a self-abandonment, if made without justice or blindly, regardless of subsequent results, may often prove not only made in vain, but harmful. Self-sacrifice can be harmful. One of the fundamental rules of theosophy is justice to oneself, viewed as a unit of collective humanity. Not as a personal self-justice, but not more, but not less than to others. Indeed, unless by sacrifice of the one self, we can benefit the many. It's the same with ahimsa and the golden rule. They have to be applied with discrimination to be sure that one is truly being nonviolent and is truly dealing with others as one would actually want to be dealt with. Haridas Chaudhuri, in Mastering the Problems of Living, tells a story that illustrates this need for discrimination in the practice of ahimsa. He tells that one time a holy man was passing through a village. Some youngsters warned him not to go near a particular tree in the hollow trunk of which a serpent lived. Every now and then, the serpent would come out of its dwelling place and work havoc by killing a goat or attacking a child. To the amazement of the children, the holy man headed directly for the tree. He bent low and seemed to whisper something to the serpent. As he resumed his journey, the youngsters gathered round him and wanted to know what he had told the serpent. The holy man said that he had given the serpent the motto of love, ahimsa. He said to the serpent, "Look, you monster, you have been committing terrible sins by killing and poisoning sacred living things. If you want to be saved, you must start practicing right from today the motto of nonviolence." The holy man left the village, and the news of his visit spread. The next day, the youngsters found the serpent meek as a lamb. Pretty soon, they gathered courage and began to handle him roughly. One day, they played tug-of-war with him, pulling at the two ends. One day, they twisted him around a twig like a rope. Then one naughty boy swirled the snake and ferociously dashed him against the tree. After that, they didn't see the snake anymore. 2 weeks later, when the holy man came back to the village, the boys reported to him the apparent death of the snake. When the holy man peeked into the hole of the tree, the coiled serpent, terribly emaciated, complained, "Look, sir, what your gospel of love has done to me. I am badly bruised and maltreated. I am mutilated. I am about to die now." And the holy man chided him, saying, "I told you not to bite any living creature, but why didn't you hiss?" There are times when we need to hiss, and maybe even times when we need to bite. In the Golden Stairs, HPB has given us a set of principles for guiding our behavior that cover many situations. The statement of the Golden Stairs contains 13 clauses or steps that fall into three large groups. The last group consists of four steps, and they give, I think, some practical suggestions about ahimsa. They'll be familiar to you, but let me remind you of them. A courageous endurance of personal injustice, a brave declaration of principles, a valiant defense of those who are unjustly attacked, and a constant eye to the ideal of human progression and perfection which the sacred science depicts. These are the golden stairs, up the steps of which the learner may climb to the temple of divine wisdom. Now, that first of these last four steps is to endure courageously injustice directed against oneself. This is the substance of Christ's admonition to turn the other cheek. And it's not unrealistic, impractical, sentimental advice. It is the most realistic, practical course one can follow. As the Buddha said, "If a man foolishly does me wrong, I will return to him the protection of my ungrudging love. The more evil comes from him, the more good shall go from me." For the fact is that evil does not cease by evil, nor hatred by hatred, but evil ceases only by being confronted with good, and hatred by being confronted with love. This fact was the basis of Gandhi's satyagraha, his social action, which means holding on to truth. It was also the basis of Martin Luther King's passive resistance. As Gandhi and as King demonstrated, our response to evil and hatred and injustice should not, however, be one of merely passive acquiescence. The next step of the Golden Stairs tells us that in the midst of our courageous endurance, we must do something else, namely, bravely declare those principles on which we stand and from which we act. The principles that lead us to a nonviolent and loving response. Gandhi made the distinction very clear. He said, "Not to yield your soul to the conqueror means that you will refuse to do that which your conscience forbids you to do. Suppose the enemy were to ask you to rub your nose on the ground or to pull your ears or to go through such humiliating performance. You will not submit to any of these humiliations. But if he robs you of your possessions, you will yield them. Because as a votary of ahimsa, you have from the beginning decided that earthly possessions have nothing to do with your soul." Now that's topsy-turvy from the standpoint of ordinary logic. Here, earthly possessions are viewed as of infinitely less worth than one's interior conscience. To lose possessions is to lose nothing of enduring value. To violate one's conscience is to risk breaking the golden cord that binds the personality to the immortal self. Thus, it is imperative, while enduring personal injustice, to declare the basis of one's response, and thus of one's conscience. It's also important to be aware that we are not asked to endure injustice to another. The next step of the Golden Stairs, on the contrary, tells us to defend valiantly any who suffer an unjust attack. Now, how far may such a defense go and still remain within the bounds of ahimsa? That's the question you and I have to answer when the time and occasion demand. His Holiness, the present Dalai Lama, a man noted for his gentleness and long-suffering forbearance of violence, has said something on the question. Those of you who were here last year and heard the Dalai Lama will have a feeling of the intense peacefulness and lovingness of that man. Here is what he said. I believe that having a sympathetic heart, a warm heart, a kind heart, is the essence or the most important thing. Irrespective of whether you believe in a religion or not, or no matter what ideology you follow, if you have this, then even such a violent act as killing someone, if it is done with a really good motive, could go beyond the usual level of killing. Ahimsa is no simple matter. And there are no simple answers to our moral problems. Someone has said that to every difficult question, there is an answer which is clear, direct, simple, obvious, and wrong. How do we make the necessary discriminations to know when someone has been unjustly attacked, or what degree and kind of force we ourselves may use in defending such a person without crossing the boundary into violence? The last step of the Golden Stairs gives us the direction in which to look for that discrimination. We are to consider all actions in the light of the ideal of human progression and perfection that the secret doctrine reveals. We have come forth from the one into the manifold. It is our destiny to return again to the one, enriched by our experience of the many. Whatever helps in that return and in perfecting our natures is ahimsa, nonviolence, love. Nonviolence is not, however, by any means the same thing as absence of struggle. HPB, who could certainly not be charged with being an uncritical Darwinian, does everybody agree? One would not normally think of her as being a Darwinian. Nevertheless, she accepted two of the key concepts in the doctrine of Darwinian evolution and pointed out that they long antedated Darwin himself. In The Secret Doctrine, she says, the idea of Darwinian-like evolution, of struggle for life and supremacy, and of the survival of the fittest, among the hosts above as well as the hosts below, runs throughout both the volumes of our earlier work, Isis Unveiled, published in 1876. But, she goes on, the idea is not ours, it is that of antiquity. The struggle for existence and the survival of the fittest reigned supreme from the moment that cosmos manifested into being and could hardly escape the observant eye of the ancient sages. End of quote. Struggle is not incompatible with ahimsa, because harmless nonviolence is not primarily a matter of what we do, but of the motive, the intention out of which we act. We are here touching upon one of the most difficult of all philosophical and moral questions, the problem of evil. It was basically the problem we discussed yesterday afternoon. Human beings have doubtless struggled with this problem as long as they have had minds to do so. In theistic religions, the problem is put this way. If God is both all good and all powerful, why does he permit evil to exist? The book of Job in the Jewish scriptures considers the problem, as does the great epic poem Paradise Lost by John Milton. Works that deal with this problem are called theodicies, from the Greek word theos, God, and dike, justice. What is the justice of God? The secret doctrine envisions no creator God of whom such a question could be asked, but the problem still exists. And HPD suggests that what we call evil is as much a part of the nature of things as what we call good. Again, from the secret doctrine. Thus, says HPB, when the occultist says that the demon is the inverse of God, and here she is quoting a very old Kabbalistic aphorism, daemon est deus inversus, the demon is God upside down. Thus, when the occultist says that the demon is the inverse of God, that evil is the reverse of the metal, he does not mean two separate actualities, good and evil, but two aspects or facets of the same unity, end quote. How can that be? What we call evil is sometimes the impulse to diversity, to separateness, to matter, which is necessary for the universe to exist. It is the path of manifestation, of pravriti, which leads to samsara, this great illusion we're all in. On the other hand, what we call good is the impulse to oneness, to unity, to spirit. It's the path of nivriti that leads to nirvana, the unity of all things. In this sense, evil and good are relative to the position one has on the path. Behavior that is appropriate and good on the path of forthgoing becomes inappropriate and evil on the path of return. In this sense, evil is merely displaced good. One implication of this view is that evil, including war and violence, has a place in the economy of the cosmos. Now that is a tough implication, and also a highly unpopular one. But it's a theme of the Bhagavad Gita and of the pamphlet which Carl mentioned a day or two ago, The High Purpose of War by Annie Besant. In times of international conflict, it is tempting, of course, to seek justification for one's own nation and to assume that God, or if we're theosophists, Dharma, is on our side, and that the other side is evil, is wrong. But the fact that a truth can be distorted jingoistically does not make it less a truth. Shiva the destroyer is as necessary to the divine economy as Brahma the creator. The body needs both anabolism and catabolism to survive. Unrestricted growth is not good, it's cancer. Civilizations are built up and civilizations must be torn down. The process of destroying and tearing down is often necessarily a strifeful and strident one. It is always a very difficult decision to know when evil is fulfilling a proper and necessary place in the world process, but it's a decision each person has to make. There are other times when what we call evil is a learning experience, a testing of the boundaries that hedge our behavior. Just like the children mentioned earlier, who need rules and regulations and who need to know where those rules lie, so all human beings, all of us, are constantly pushing at the boundaries of karma, testing the great law that governs the universe to find out what it is. In this sense, evil is our effort to find where we are and the consequences of the inexorable law that teaches us we have gone too far. When we lose our tempers, behave violently, or harm one another, we are really harming ourselves. And the great law sees to it that we find out that. Karma is, in this sense, not punishment, but education. And the lords of karma are not our stern disciplinarians, but our loving teachers. If we had the eyes of prophecy and could see the whole world process in the here and now of which Emily spoke last night, we could, as William Blake said, see the universe in a grain of sand and eternity in an hour. And so we could understand the cosmic pattern of things, and we would see that all things, even war and violence, have their place in that pattern. But of course, to see things that way requires a very large vision. When God spoke to Job out of the whirlwind, you remember Job, who had all sorts of bad things happen to him and couldn't figure out why, because he'd never done anything to deserve them that he could figure out? And he asked God, in effect, why do you do all this? And God's answer to Job out of the whirlwind began, where were you when I laid the foundations of the world? To comprehend that great pattern which embraces and harmonizes all things, even war and violence, as well as peace and love, the demonic as well as the divine, we need a vision that stretches from the foundation of the world to its dissolution. Without such a vision, we can only trust that the great plan does, in fact, order all things. There was a 14th century English mystic named St. Juliana of Norwich. St. Juliana used to have visions of Christ and the saints, but she was profoundly disturbed, profoundly troubled by one problem. She knew from church teaching that in order to be saved, one had to be baptized, and if you were not baptized, you were to be damned eternally. And poor Juliana began worrying about all of the souls in the world who had never been baptized, the little babies who died before baptism, all of the good men who lived and women who lived before Christ, all of those who had never had an opportunity for baptism. And she took that tremendous problem to Christ in one of her visions. And in that vision, Christ, as it were, patted her on the head and reassured her. In St. Juliana's report of the vision, this is what he said. All shall be well, and all shall be well, and all shall be well. It is upon such assurance from the higher self to the personality, from the one to the many, that we must rely. But to come back to the question with which these remarks began, how do theosophists respond to specific acts of war and violence? That's a question, let me suggest to you, that only individual theosophists can answer, each of us, within the privacy of our own consciences. The principles that theosophists can be expected to follow in viewing war and violence are clear enough. They are principles embodied in the concept of ahimsa, in the golden rule, in the last four steps of the golden stairs. But those principles still have to be applied in specific cases. And they can be applied only by individuals, each looking to the dictates of our individual consciences, which are, however, let me remind you, finally one conscience, as we ourselves are finally one. Our view of war and violence must grow out of our view of our oneness and of the love that unites all humanity and all beings. That's the love of which Dante spoke at the end of the Divine Comedy when he said, it is the love which rules the sun and the other stars. Now, the world is presently threatened by war and violence. But, of course, it has always been so threatened. What is more threatening today is the awful ability we have developed to wage war and to inflict violence. But maybe violence is less what we do than how we do it. Our attitude, our motive. And motives and attitudes are individual responsibilities. The world cannot be at peace until you and I are at peace within ourselves. But how, we may ask, can a few persons have any effect on the whole world? A bit of leaven, as Christ says in the Gospels, can raise the whole loaf.
No one knows how great the effect is of even a few persons who live or strive to live at peace within themselves. Joy mentioned in her talk the other evening a Kabbalistic tradition that says that in the world there are 36 perfectly just persons. And it is on account of those 36 just persons that the world continues to exist. They are the true radicals of the world. If they ceased to be, so would all of the rest of us. Now, that tradition expresses symbolically a great truth. The peace and progress of the world depend on and grow out of the lives of those persons, however few their number may be, who lead lives of peace and wisdom and love. As members of the society, we are called upon to lead lives of ahimsa, which means striving to join that small select company of the perfectly just, those whom we call the masters. We are called upon ourselves to become radical, as Joy pointed out. We are called upon to become radical as the just persons are radical. That is, rooted in the one life. Our efforts in that direction, no matter how small, no matter how isolated, will eventually bear fruit. Arlene Heinz, in her remarks as director, quoted lyrics from a song, which are, I think, perfectly appropriate here, and I'd like to end with them. Let there be peace on earth, and let it begin with me. Thank you.